Hi, hello, and welcome to the third installment of The Talking Show here on Kaechung Radio, your very own Chinatown area micro-broadcasting AM radio station. I'm one of your hosts, Steve Cato.
And I'm the other, Nicholas Miller.
And boy, Nick, the weather has been just terrible for this time of year in Los Angeles,
yeah.
Don't you think?
No, I totally agree, but we really can't complain too much, you know. It's bad, but I've got, for the most part, conditioned air in my car, and when that goes out, I roll the windows up and I can just sweat. You know, I think that's really good for the pores and all that kind of stuff. And you know, the bottom line out here in LA is that anything's better than fire, right?
I mean, sure. I guess it's, you know, of course, it's very easy for us to complain here in Los Angeles about a few days of cloud or unseasonably cool weather, but it's true. I mean, people all over this continent have had such terrible weather, from floods up in the central north to, you know, also just terrible flooding all the way down through the south.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. You know, we really have very little to complain about here. You're absolutely right, Nick. Anyway, our guest today is a renowned visual artist, Paul Chan. He's going to be showing us a little bit from his My Own Private Alexandria project. Do you have anything you'd like to say about that, Nick?
Yeah. I'm just excited as you are, Steve. It's really great to have Paul here with us. And especially, particularly exciting, because he's going to be talking about Heidegger, or talking through Heidegger or something like that, which I think will be really exciting to hear. So, yeah.
Right. So we're just going to go straight on in. Our technologist here, our studio wizard, Walter, here in the background, he's just getting Paul wired up.
Right.
And, we've got a few more seconds left, Walter says. Anything you'd like to say, Nick?
I think we should give a warm thanks to Wally. He's been phenomenal here at these gorgeous studios in Chinatown. We can't thank him enough. But I'm getting a little bit hungry. So, Wally, could we get this show on the road? Yeah?
It looks like Walter's got Paul wired up right now. So we're ready to go. We're ready to let Paul take the floor. Sit back, relax, have a great time, and we'll speak to you after Paul's done. Thanks.
The Thing by Martin Heidegger. All distances in time and space are shrinking. Man now reaches overnight, by plane, places which formerly took weeks and months of travel. He now receives instant information, by radio, of events which he formerly learned about only years later, if at all. The germination and growth of plants, which remain hidden throughout the seasons, is now exhibited publicly in a minute, on film. Distant sites of the most ancient cultures are shown on film, as if they stood at this very moment amidst today's street traffic. Moreover, the film attests to what it shows by presenting also the camera and its operators at work. The peak of this abolition of every possibility of remoteness is reached by television, which will soon pervade and dominate the whole machinery of communication. Man puts the longest distance behind him in the shortest time. He puts the greatest distances behind himself, and thus puts everything before himself at the shortest range. Yet the frantic abolition of all distances brings no nearness, for nearness does not consist in shortness of distance. What is least remote from us in point of distance, by virtue of its picture on film or its sound on the radio, can remain far from us. What is incalculably far from us in point of distance can be near to us. Short distance is not in itself nearness, nor is great distance remoteness. What is nearness if it fails to come about despite the reduction of the longest distances to the shortest intervals? What is nearness if it is even repelled by the restless abolition of distances? What is nearness if, along with its failure to appear, remoteness also remains absent? What is happening here when, as a result of the abolition of great distances, everything is equally far and equally near? What is this uniformity in which everything is neither far nor near, is, as it were, without distance? Everything gets lumped together into uniform distantlessness. How? Is not this merging of everything into the distantlessness more unearthly than everything bursting apart? Man stares at what the explosion of the atom bomb could bring about. Repeat. Man stares at what the explosion of the atom bomb could bring with it. He does not see that the atom bomb and its explosion are the mere final emission of what has long since taken place, has already happened, not to mention the single hydrogen bomb, whose triggering, thought through to its utmost potential, might be enough to snuff all life on Earth. What is this helpless anxiety still waiting for, if the terrible has already happened? The terrifying is unsettling. It places everything outside its own nature. What is it that unsettles and thus terrifies? It shows itself and hides itself in the way in which everything presences, namely, in the fact that despite all conquest of distances, the nearness of things remains absent. What about nearness? How can we come to know its nature? Nearness, it seems, cannot be encountered directly. We succeed in reaching it rather by attending to what is near. Near to us are what we usually call things. But what is a thing? Man has so far given no more thought to the thing as a thing than he has to nearness. The jug is a thing. What is the jug? We say, a vessel, something of that kind that holds something else within it. The jug's holding is done by its base and sides. This container itself can again be held by the handle. As a vessel, the jug is something self-sustained, something that stands on its own. This standing on its own characterizes the jug as something that is self-supporting or independent. As the self-supporting independence of something independent, the jug differs from an object. An independent, self-supporting thing may become an object if we place it before us, whether in immediate perception or by bringing it to mind in a recollective representation. However, the thingly character of the thing does not consist in its being a represented object, nor can it be defined in any way in terms of its objectness, the over-againstness of the object. The jug remains a vessel whether we represent it in our minds or not. As a vessel, the jug stands on its own as self-supporting. But what does it mean to say that the container stands on its own? Does the vessel's self-support alone define the jug as a thing? Clearly, the jug stands as a vessel only because it has brought to a stand. Repeat. Clearly, the jug stands as a vessel only because it has been brought to a stand. This happened during, and happens by means of, a process of setting forth, namely, by producing the jug. The potter makes the earthen jug out of earth that he has specially chosen and prepared for it. The jug consists of that earth. By virtue of what the jug consists of, it too can stand on the earth, either immediately or through the mediation of a table and bench. What exists by such producing is what stands on its own, is self-supporting. When we take the jug as a made vessel, then surely we are apprehending it, so it seems, as a thing and never as a mere object. Or do we even now still take the jug as an object? Indeed, it is, to be sure, no longer considered only an object of the mere act of representation, but in return it is an object which a process of making has set up before and against us. Its self-support seems to mark the jug as a thing. but in truth, we are thinking of this self-support in terms of the making process. Self-support is what the making aims at. But even so, the self-support is still thought of in terms of objectness, even though the over-againstness of what has been put forth is no longer grounded in its mere representation, in the mere putting it before our minds. But from the objectness of the object, and from the product's self-support, there is no way that leads to the thingness of the thing. What in the thing is thingly? What is the thing in itself? We shall not reach the thing in itself until our thinking has first reached the thing as a thing. The jug is a thing as a vessel. It can hold something. To be sure, this container has to be made. But its being made by the potter is in no way constitutes what is peculiar and proper to the jug insofar as it is qua jug. The jug is not a vessel because it was made. Rather, the jug had to be made because it is this holding vessel. Repeat. The jug is not a vessel because it was made. Rather, the jug had to be made because it is this holding vessel. The making, it is true, lets the jug come into its own. But that which in the jug's nature is its own is never brought about by its making. Now released from the making process, the self-supporting jug has to gather itself for the task of containing. In the process of its making, of course, the jug must first show its outward appearance to the maker. But what shows itself here, the aspect, the ideos, the idea, characterizes the jug solely in the respect in which the vessel stands over against the maker as something to be made. Repeat. But what shows itself here, the aspect, the ideos, the idea, characterizes the jug solely in the respect in which the vessel stands over against the maker as something to be made. But what the vessel in this aspect is as this jug, what and how the jug is as this jug thing, something we can never learn, let alone think properly, by looking at the outward appearance, the idea. That is why Plato, who conceived of the presence of what is present in terms of the outward appearance, had no more understanding of the nature of the thing than did Aristotle and all subsequent thinkers. Rather, Plato experienced, decisively indeed, for the sequel, everything present as an object of making. Instead of object, quote-unquote, as that which stands before, over against, opposite us, we use the more precise expression, quote-unquote, what stands forth. In the full nature of what stands forth, a twofold standing prevails. First, standing forth has the sense of stemming from somewhere, whether this be a process of self-making or of being made by another. Secondly, standing forth has the sense of the made things standing forth into the unconcealedness of what is already present. Nevertheless, no representation of what is present in the sense of what stands forth and of what stands over against as an object ever reaches to the thing qua thing. The jug's thingness resides in its being qua vessel. We become aware of the vessel's holding nature when we fill the jug. The jug's bottom and sides obviously take on the task of holding, but not so fast. When we fill the jug with wine, do we pour the wine into the sides and bottom? At most, we pour the wine between the sides and over the bottom. Sides and bottom are, to be sure, what is impermeable in the vessel. But what is impermeable is not yet what does the holding. When we fill the jug, the pouring that fills it flows into the empty jug. The emptiness, the void, is what does the vessel's holding, the emptying space. This nothing of the jug is what the jug is as the holding vessel. But the jug does consist of sides and bottom, but that of which the jug consists, it stands. What would a jug be that did not stand? Or at least a jug, a manique, hence a jug still, namely, one that would indeed hold, but that, constantly falling over, would empty itself of what it holds. Only a vessel, however, can empty itself. Sides and bottom, of which the jug consists and by which it stands, are not really what does the holding. But if the holding is done by the jug's void, then the potter who forms sides and bottom on his wheel does not, strictly speaking, make the jug. He only shapes the clay. No, he shapes the void, for in it and out of it he forms the clay into the form. From start to finish, the potter takes hold of the impalpable void and brings it forth as the container in the shape of a containing vessel. The jug's void determines all the handling in the process of making the vessel. The vessel's thingness does not lie in all in the material of which it consists, but in the void that holds. And yet, is the jug really empty? Physical science assures us that the jug is filled with air and with everything that goes to make up the air's mixture. We allowed ourselves to be misled by semi-poetic ways of looking at things when we pointed to the void of the jug in order to define its acting as a container. But as soon as we agree to study the actual jug scientifically in regard to its reality, the facts turn out differently. When we pour wine into a jug, the air that's already fills the jug is simply displaced by the liquid. Considered scientifically, to fill a jug means to exchange one filling for another. These statements of physics are correct. By means of them, science represents something real, by which it is objectively controlled. But is this reality, the jug? No. Science always encounters only what its kind of representation has admitted beforehand as an object possible for science. Repeat, but is this reality, the jug? No. Science always encounters only what its kind of representation has admitted beforehand as an object possible for science. It is said that scientific knowledge is compelling, certainly, but what does its compulsion consist in? In our instance, it consists in the compulsion to relinquish the wine-filled jug and to put in its place a hollow within which a liquid spreads. Science makes the jug thing into a non-entity in not permitting things to be the standard for what is real. Science's knowledge, which is compelling within its own sphere, the sphere of objects, already had annihilated things as things long before the atom bomb exploded. The bomb's explosion is only the grossest of all gross confirmation of the long since accomplished annihilation of the thing. The confirmation that the thing as a thing remains nil. The thingness of the thing remains concealed, forgotten. The nature of the thing never comes to light. That is, it never gets a hearing. This is the meaning of our talk about the annihilation of the thing. That annihilation is so weird because it carries before it a twofold delusion. First, the notion that science is superior to all other experience in reaching the real in its reality. And second, the illusion that, notwithstanding the scientific investigation of reality, things could still be things, which would presuppose that they had once been in full possession of their thinghood. But if things ever had already shown themselves qua things in their thingness, then the thing's thingness would have become manifest and would have laid claim to thought. In truth, however, the thing as thing remains proscribed, nil, and in that sense, annihilated. This has happened and continues to happen so essentially that not only are things no longer admitted as things, but that they have never at all been able to appear to thinking as things. To what is the non-appearance of the thing as thing due? Is it simply that man has neglected to represent the thing as thing to himself? Man has neglected only what has already been assigned to man. Man can represent, no matter how, only what has previously come to light of its own accord and has shown itself to him in the light it brought with it. What, then, is the thing as thing, that its essential nature has never yet been able to appear? Has the thing never yet come near enough for man to learn how to attend sufficiently to the thing as thing? What is nearness? We have already asked this question before. To learn what nearness is, we examine the jug nearby. In what does the jug character of the jug consist? We suddenly lose sight of it. At the moment, in fact, when the illusion intruded itself that science could reveal to us the reality of the jug, we represent the effective feature of the vessel, that which does its holding, the void, as the hollow filled with air. Conceived in terms of physical science, that is what the void really is. But it is not the jug's void. We did not let the jug's void be its own void. We paid no heed to that in the vessel which does the containing. We have given no thought to how the containing itself goes on. Accordingly, even what the jug contains was liquid. Repeat. We have given no thought to how the containing itself goes on. Accordingly, even what the jug contains was bound to escape us. In the scientific view, the jug became a liquid, and liquidity in turn became one of the states of aggregation of matter, possible everywhere. We failed to give thought to what the jug holds and how it holds. How does the jug's void hold? It holds by taking what is poured in. It holds by keeping and retaining what it took in. The void holds in a twofold manner, taking and keeping. The word hold, quote unquote, is therefore ambiguous. Nevertheless, the taking of what is poured in and the keeping of what was poured belong together. But their unity is determined by the outpouring of which the jug is fitted as a jug. The twofold holding of the void rests on the outpouring. In the outpouring, the holding is automatic, authentically how it is. Repeat, in the outpouring, the holding is authentically how it is. To pour from the jug is to give. The holding of the vessel occurs in the giving of the outpouring. Holding needs the void as that which holds. The nature of the holding void is gathered in the giving. But giving is richer than the mere pouring out. The giving, whereby the jug is a jug, gathers in the twofold holding, in the outpouring. We call the gathering of the twofold holding into the outpouring, which, as a being together, first constitutes the full presence of giving, the poured gift. The jug's jug character consists in the poured gift of the pouring out. Even the empty jug retains its nature by virtue of the poured gift, even though the empty jug does not admit of a giving out. But this non-admission belongs to the jug and to it alone. A scythe, by contrast, or hammer, is capable of a non-admission of this giving. The giving of the outpouring can be a drink. The outpouring gives water. It gives wine to drink. The spring stays on in the water of the gift. In the spring the rocks dwell, and in the rock dwells the dark slumber of the earth, which receives the rain and dew of the sky. In the water of the spring dwells the marriage of sky and earth. It stays in the wine given by the fruit of the vine, the fruit in which the earth's nourishment and the sky's sun are betrothed to one another. In the gift of water, in the gift of wine, earth and sky dwell. But the gift of the outpourings is what makes the jug a jug. In the jugness of the jug, sky and earth dwell. The gift of the pouring out is drink for mortals. It quenches their thirst. It refreshes their leisure. It enlivens their convivial. Repeat. It enlivens their conviviality. But the jug's gift is at times also given for consecration. If the pouring is for consecration, then it does not still a drink. Repeat, if the pouring is for consecration, then it does not still a thirst. It stills and elevates the celebration of the feast. The gift of the pouring now is neither given in an inn, nor is the poured gift a drink for mortals. The outpouring is the libation poured out for the immortal gods. The gift of the outpouring as libation is the authentic gift. In giving the consecrated libation, the pouring jug occurs as a giving gift. The consecrated libation is what our word for a strong outpouring flow, gush, quote-unquote, really designates, gift and sacrifice. Gush, quote-unquote, Middle English, gushen, goshen, and in German, gus, geisen, is the Greek chiron, kiron, the Indo-European gong. It means to offer in sacrifice. To pour a gush, when it is achieved in its essence, thought through with sufficient generosity and genuinely uttered, is to donate, to offer in sacrifice, and hence to give. It is only for this reason that the pouring of the gush, once its nature withers, can become a mere pouring in and pouring out, until it finally decays into the dispensing of liquor at the bar. Pouring the outpour is not a mere filling and decanting. In the gift of the outpouring that is drink, mortals stay in their own way. In the gift of the outpouring that is libation, the divinities stay in their own way. They who receive back the gift of giving as the gift of the donation. In the gift of the outpouring, mortals and divinities each dwell in their different ways. Earth and sky dwell in the gift of the outpouring. In the gift of the outpouring, earth and sky, the divinities and mortals dwell together all at once. These four, at one because of what they themselves are, belong together. Preceding everything that is present, they are enfolded into a single fourfold. In the gift of the outpouring dwells the simple single-foldedness of the four. The gift of the outpouring is a gift because it stays earth and sky, divinities and mortals. Yet staying is now no longer the mere persisting of something that is here. Staying appropriates. It brings the four into the light of their mutual belonging. From out of staying's simple one-foldedness, they are betrothed, entrusted to one another. At one in thus being entrusted to one another, they are unconcealed. The gift of the outpouring stays the one-fold of the fourfold of the four. And in a poured gift, the jug presences as jug. The gift gathers what belongs to giving. The twofold containing, the container, the void, and the outpouring as donation. What is gathered in the gift gathers itself in appropriately staying the fourfold. This manifold, simple gathering is the jug's presencing. Our language denotes what a gathering is by an ancient word. That word is thing. The jug's presencing is the pure, giving gathering of the one-fold, fourfold into a single time-space, a single stay. The jug presences as a thing. The jug is the jug as a thing. But how does the thing presence? The thing things. Thinging gathers. Appropriating the fourfold, it gathers the fourfold stay, its while, into something that stays for a while, into this thing, that thing. The jug's essential nature, its presencing, so experienced and thought of in these terms, is what we call thing. We are now thinking this word by way of the gathering, appropriating, staying of the fourfold. At the same time, we recall the High German, the old High German word, thing. This reference to the history of language could easily tempt us to misunderstand the way in which we are now thinking of the nature of the thing. It might look as though the nature of the thing as we are now thinking of it had been, so to speak, thoughtlessly poked out of the accidental encountered meaning of the old High German thing. The suspicion arises that the understanding of the nature of the thingness that we are here trying to reach may be based on the accidents of an etymological game. Repeat. The suspicion arises that the understanding of the nature of the thingness that we are here trying to reach may be based on the accidents of an etymological game. The notion becomes established and is already current that, instead of giving thought to essential matters, we are here merely using the dictionary. The opposite is true. To be sure, the old High German word thing means a gathering, and specifically a gathering to deliberate on a matter under discussion, a contested matter. In consequence, the old German words thing and dink becomes the names for an affair or matters of pertinence. They denote anything that in any way bears upon men, concerns them, and that accordingly is the matter for discourse. The Romans call a matter for discourse res. The Greek iro, retos, reta, rema, means to speak about something, to deliberate on it. Res publica means not the state, but that which everyone, known to everyone, concerns everybody, and is therefore deliberated in public. Only because res means what concerns men are the combination, repeat. Only because res means what concerns men are the combinations res adversaire, comma, res seculaire, possible. The first is what affects or bears on men adversely. The second, what attends men favorably. The dictionaries, to be sure, translate res adversaire correctly as bad fortune, and res seculaire as good fortune. But dictionaries have little to report about what words, spoken thoughtfully, say. The truth, then, here and elsewhere, is not that our thinking feeds on etymology. Repeat. The truth, then, here and elsewhere, is not that our thinking feeds on etymology, but rather that etymology has the standing mandate first to give thought to the essential content involved in what dictionary words, as words, denote by implication. The Roman word res designates that which concerns somebody, an affair, a contested matter, a case at law. The Romans also use for it the word causa. In its authentic and original sense, this word in no way signifies cause, quote-unquote. Causa means the case and hence also that which is the case, in the sense that something comes to pass and becomes due. Only because causa, almost synonymously with res, means the case, can the word causa later come to mean cause, in the sense of the causality of an effect. The old German word thing, or ding, with its meaning of a gathering specifically for the purpose of dealing with a case or matter, is suited as no other word to translate properly the Roman word res, that which is pertinent, which has a bearing. From that word of the Roman language, which there corresponds to the word res, from the word causa in the sense of case, affair, matter of pertinence, there develop in turn the Romance la causa and the French la chose. We say, quote-unquote, the thing. In English, thing has still preserved the full semantic power of the Roman word. He knows his things, quote-unquote. He understands the matters that have a bearing on him. He knows how to handle things, quote-unquote. He knows how to go about dealing with affairs, that is, with what matters from case to case. That's a great thing, quote-unquote. That is something grand, fine, tremendous, splendid, something that comes of itself and bears upon man. But the decisive point now is not at all the short semantic history here given to the words, res, ding, causa, cosa, chosa, and thing, but something altogether different, to which no thought whatever has hitherto been given. The Roman word res denotes what pertains to man, concerns him and his interests in any way or manner. That which concerns man is what is real in res. The Roman experience of the realitas of res is that of a bearing upon a concern. But the Romans never properly thought through the nature of what they thus experience. Rather, the Roman realitas of res is conceived in terms of the meaning of the on, which they took over from the Greek philosophy. On, Latin ins, means that which is present in the sense of standing forth here. Res become ins, that which is present in the sense of what is put here. put before us, presented. The peculiar relatus of res, as originally experienced by the Romans, a bearing upon or concern, i.e. the very nature of that which is present, remains buried. Conversely, in later times, especially in the Middle Ages, the term res reserves to designate every ens qua ens, that is, everything present in any way whatever, even if it stands forth and presences only in mental representations as an ens rationis. That's the same happens with the corresponding term thing or ding, for these words denote anything whatever that is in any way. Accordingly, Meister Eckhart uses the word thing for God as well as for the soul. God is for him, quote, the highest and uppermost thing, unquote. The soul is, quote, great thing, unquote. This master of thinking is, quote, repeat, this master of thinking in no way means to say that God and the soul are something like a rock, a material object. Thing is here the cautious and abstemious name for something that is at all. Thus, Meister Eckhart says, adopting an expression of Dionysus, the Areopagite. Oh, jeez. Blah, blah, blah. Something in Latin. Repeat. Thus, Meister Eckhart says, adopting an expression of Dionysus, Areopagite. Something in Latin, which translates to, love is of such a nature that it changes man into the things he loves. Repeat. Love is of such a nature that it changes man into the things he loves. Because the word thing, as used in Western metaphysics, denotes that which is at all and is something in some way or another, the meaning of the name thing varies with the interpretation of that which is, of entities. Kant talks about things in the same way as Meister Eckhart and means by the term something that is. But for Kant, that which is becomes the object of a representing that runs its course in the self-consciousness of the human ego. The thing in itself means for Kant the object in itself. To Kant, the character of the in itself, quote-unquote, signifies that the object is an object in itself without reference to the human act of representing it, that is, without the opposing ob, by which it is first of all put before this representing act. Thing in itself, thought in a rigorously Kantian way, means an object that is no object for us, because it is supposed to stay put, without a possible before, for the human representational act that encounters it. Neither the general nor outworn meaning of the term thing, as used in philosophy, nor the old High German meaning of the word thing, however, are of the least help to us in our pressing need to discover and give adequate thought to the essential source of what we are now saying about the nature of the jug. However, one semantic factor of the old usage of the word thing, namely gathering, does speak to the nature of the jug as we had it earlier in mind. The jug is a thing neither in the sense of the Roman res, nor in the sense of the medieval ens, let alone in the modern sense of object. The jug is a thing insofar as it things. The presence of something present, such as the jug, comes into its own, appropriately manifests and determines itself only from the thinging of the thing. Repeat. The jug is a thing neither in the sense of the Roman res, nor in the sense of the medieval ens, let alone in the modern sense of object. The jug is a thing insofar as it things. The presence of something manifest, such as the jug, comes into its own, appropriately manifests and determines itself only from the thinging of the thing. Today, everything presents is equally near and equally far. Repeat. Today, everything present is equally near and equally far. The distanceless, prevails, but no abridging or abolishing of distances brings nearness. What is nearness? To discover the nature of nearness, we gave thought to the jug nearby. We have sought the nature of nearness and found the nature of the jug as a thing. But in this discovery, we also catch sight of the nature of nearness. The thing things. In thinging, it stays earth and sky, divinities and mortals. Staying, the thing brings the four, in their remoteness, near to one another. This bringing nearing is nearing. Nearing is a presencing of nearness. Nearness brings near, draws nigh to one another. The far and, indeed, as the far, nearness preserves farness. Preserving farness, nearness presences nearness in nearing that farness. Bringing near in this way, nearness conceals its own self and remains, in its own way, nearest of all. The thing is not in nearness, in proximity, as if nearness were a container. Nearness is at work in bringing near, as the thinging of the thing. Thinging, the thing stays the united four, earth and sky, divinities and mortals, in a simple one-fold of the self-united fourfold. Earth is the building-bearer, nourishing with its fruits, tending water and rock, plant and animal. When we say earth, we are already thinking of the other three along with it by way of the simple oneness of the four. The sky is the sun's path, the course of the moon, the glittering of the stars, the year's seasons, the light and dusk of day, the gloom and glow of night, the clemency and inclemency of the weather, the drifting clouds and the blue depth of the ether. Repeat. The sky is the sun's path, the course of the moon, the glittering of the stars, the year's seasons, the light and dusk of day, the gloom and glow of night, the clemency and inclemency of the weather, the drifting clouds and the blue depth of the ether. When we say sky, we are already thinking of the other three along with it by way of the simple oneness of the four. The divinities are the beckoning messengers of the Godhead. Out of its hidden sway of the divinities, the God emerges as what he is, which removes him from any comparison with beings that are present. When we speak of divinities, we are already thinking of the other three along with them by way of the simple oneness of the four. The mortals are human beings. They are called mortals because they can die. To die means to be capable of death as death. Only man dies. The animal perishes. It has death neither ahead nor... Repeat. It has death neither ahead of itself nor behind it. Death is the shrine of nothing, that is, of that which in every respect is never something that merely exists, but which nevertheless presences, even as the mystery of being itself. As the shrine of nothing, death harbors within itself the presencing of being. As the shrine of nothing, death is the shelter of being. We now call mortals mortals, not because their earthly life comes to an end, but because they are capable of death as death. Mortals are who they are as mortals, present in the shelter of being. They are the presencing relation to being as being. Metaphysics, by contrast, thinks of man as animal. Repeat. Metaphysics, by contrast, thinks of man as animal, as a living being. Even when ratio pervades animalitas, man's being remains defined by life and life experience. Rational living beings must first become mortals. When we say mortals, we are then thinking of the other three along with them by way of the simple oneness of the four. Earth and sky, divinities and mortals, being at one with another of their own accord, belong together by way of the simpleness of the united fourfold, each of the four mirrors in its own way the presences of the others, each therewith reflecting itself in its own way into its own, within the simpleness of the four. This mirroring does not portray a likeness. This mirroring, lightening each of the four, appropriates their own presencing into simple belonging to one another. Mirroring in this appropriating, lightening way each of the four plays to each of the others. The appropriative mirroring of sets each of the four free into its own, but it binds these free ones into the simplicity of their essential being towards one another. The mirroring that binds into freedom is the play that betroths each of the four to each through the enfolding clasp of their mutual appropriation. None of the four insists on its own separate particularity. Rather, each is expropriated within their own mutual appropriation into its own being. This expropriative appropriating is the mirror play of the fourfold. Out of the fourfold, the simple onefold of the four is ventured. This appropriating mirror play of the simple onefold of earth and sky, divinities and mortals, we call the world. Repeat. This appropriating mirror play of the simple onefold of earth and sky, divinities and mortals, we call the world. The world presences by worlding. That means the world's worlding cannot be explained by anything else, nor can it be fathomed through anything else. This impossibility does not lie in the inability of our human thinking to explain and fathom in this way. Rather, the inexplicable and unfathomable character of the world's worlding lies in this, that causes and grounds remain unsuitable for the world's worlding. As soon as human cognition here calls for an explanation, it fails to transcend the world's nature and falls short of it. The human will to explain just does not reach to the simpleness of the simple onefold of worlding. The united four are already strangled in their essential nature when we think of them only as separate realities, which are to be grounded in and explained by one another. The unity of the fourfold is the fouring, but the fouring does not come about in such a way that it encompasses the four and only afterward is added to them as that compass. Nor does the fouring exhaust itself in this, that the four, once they are there, stand side by side singly. The fouring, the unity of the four, presences as the appropriative, as the appropriating mirror play of the betrothed, each to the other in simple oneness. The fouring presences as the worlding of world. The mirror play of world is the round dance of appropriating. Therefore, the round dance does not encompass the four like a hoop. The round dance is the ring that joins while it plays as mirroring. Appropriating, it lightens the four into the radiance of their simple oneness. Radiantly, the ring joins the four, everywhere open to the riddle of the presence, the gathered presence of the mirror play of the world. Joining in this way is the ringing. In the ringing of the mirror playing ring, the four nestle into their unifying presence, in which each one retains its own nature. So nestling, they join together. Repeat, so nestling, they join together, worlding the world. Nestling, malleable, pliant, compliant, nimble. In old German, these are called ring and gering. The mirror play of the world, repeat, the mirror play of the worlding world, as the ringing of the ring, rests free the united four into their own compliancy. The circling compliancy of their presence. Out of the ringing mirror play, the thinging of the thing takes place. The thing stays, gathers and unites the fourfold. The thing things world. Each thing stays the fourfold into a happening of the simple onehood of world. Repeat. The thing stays, gathers and unites the fourfold. The thing things world. Each thing stays the fourfold into a happening of the simple onehood of world. If we let the thing be present in its thinging from out of the worlding world, then we are thinking of the thing as thing. Thinking thought in this way, we let ourselves be concerned by the thing's worlding being. Thinking in this way, we are called by the thing as the thing. In the strictest sense of the German word, bindingsch, we are the bethinged, the conditioned ones. We have left behind us the presumption of all unconditioned. Repeat. We have left behind us the presumption of all unconditionedness. If we think of the thing as thing, then we spare and protect the thing's presence in the region from which it presences. Thinging is the nearing of world. Nearing is the nature of nearness. As we preserve the thing qua thing, we inhabit nearness. The nearing of nearness is the true and sole dimension of the mirror play of the world. The failure of nearness to materialize in consequence of the abolition of all distances has brought the distantless to the dominance. Repeat. The failure of nearness to materialize in consequence of the abolition of all distances has brought the distantless to domination. In the default of nearness, the thing remains annihilated as a thing in our sense. But when and in what way do things exist as things? This is the question we raise in the midst of the dominance of the distantless. When and in what way do things appear as things? They do not appear by means of human making, but neither do they appear without the vigilance of mortals. The first step toward such vigilance is the step back from the thinking that merely represents, that is, explains, to the thinking that responds and recalls. The step back from the one thinking to the other is no mere shift of attitude. It can never be any such thing for this reason alone, that all attitudes, including the ways in which they shift, remain committed to the precincts of representational thinking. The step back does, indeed, depart from the sphere of mere attitudes. The step back takes up its residence in the co-responding which, appealed to in the world's being by the world's being, answers within itself to that appeal. Repeat. The step back takes up its residence in the co-responding which, appealed to in the world's being by the world's being, answers within itself to that appeal. A mere shift of attitude is powerless to bring about the advent of the thing as thing, just as nothing that stands today as an object in the distantless can ever be simply switched over into a thing. Nor do things as things ever come about if we merely avoid objects and recollect former objects which perhaps were once on the way to becoming things and even to actually presencing as things. Whatever becomes a thing occurs out of the ringing of the world's mirror play, only when, all of a sudden, presumably, worlds as a world, only then does the ring shine forth, the joining from which the ringing of earth and heaven, divinities and mortals, wrests itself free from that compliancy of simple oneness. In accordance with this ring, thinging itself is unpretentious, and each present thing, modestly compliant, fits into its own being. Inconspicuously compliant is the thing, the jug and the bench, the footbridge and the plow, but tree and pond too, brook and hill, are things, each in its own way. Things, each thinging from time to time in its own way, are heron and roe, deer and horse and bull. Things, each thinging and each staying in its own way, are mirror and clasp, book and picture, crown and cross. But things are also compliant and modest in number, compared with the countless objects everywhere of equal value, compared with the measureless mass of men as living beings. Men alone, as mortals, by dwelling, attain to the world as world. Repeat. Men alone, as mortals, by dwelling, attain to the world as world. Only what conjoins itself out of world becomes a thing.
Well, Nick, what do you think?
God. You know, I could barely even concentrate. You changed the studio time, so now I have to eat my early evening yogurt late during the show in front of Paul Chan.
Oh gosh, I'm sorry. You know.
And then you knocked it over and now I'm hungry.
Bulldogs don't learn new tricks so well. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, maybe you should keep to your own
stuff.
It's
a habit. I'm going to have to try to work harder on that habit.
Yeah, well, the thing is that this thing is better than the other things, so therefore it costs more and tastes better.
Yeah.
I mean, does that not make any sense to you?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
I mean, Nicholas. This type of yogurt is really tasty.
Nicholas.
God.
Nicholas G. Right. Yeah, I'm very, very sorry. Yeah. Anyway, but that was a fantastic, fantastic bit of talking from our friend Paul, who is just getting ready to go here. Walter's loosening the harness there, and he's gaining freedom of motion again, and he's off he goes.
Yeah.
And so we're wrapping up for another day here on the Talking Show. We'll see you, or rather hear you, or no, well, whether you'll hear us, sorry, next week. Well, we'll have some more fantastic guests for you. Stay dry, stay cool, and have a great week, Los Angeles. Bye.